Questlove Supreme is a production of iHeartRadio.
Hello.
How you doing? Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Questlove Supreme. I had to think for 1 second exactly where were we. I'm your host, Questlove. Thank you for joining us yet again. Here with my squid odd. What's up, Pete Build? How are you?
Man, it's a good day. Can't complain.
How's your summer?
Summer's good so far. Can't complain. Okay. Kids are happy. Camp is in session. Life is good.
Camp's in session?
Camp is in session. Summer camp is summer camp.
Oh, but summer camp in the crib, right?
No, they go away. Not like
you sent them away.
No. Like away, way, way. Just like during the day, away.
I would call that summer school, but you know.
And when they come home, I de-louse them like a prison movie. That's right.
I see that. How's it going, Sugar Steve? Fresh from your season 5?
That's right. Yep. Everything's cool. I mean, boss called me into work today, so there's that. But other than that, doing good.
Horrible boss you have there. Sorry. Anyway.
He's all right.
Laia, everything's fine?
Oh, yeah. I'm good. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yes, I can hear you loud and clear, Laia.
I'm going to turn that down.
Press the mute button.
I know what that means.
Right. Ah. How's it going, Laia?
Oh, it's going good. You mean, am I muted?
No, we can hear you now.
Okay. All right. No, yeah, it's going good. I mean, I'm excited to talk some good Philly music and whatnot.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
All right. Well, speaking of which, ladies and gentlemen, speaking of Philly music, our guest today is the pride of the city of Detroit, Michigan. Via Philadelphia.
Right.
Via Philadelphia. Yeah, along with her sisters, the great Brenda and Valerie Jones, I will say that our guest today, along with her two sisters, probably the go-to background combo trio in the mid-70s. They kind of dominated that platform, sort of similar to how Sissy Houston and the Sweet Inspirations once did in the mid to late 60s, for many luminaries, from Aretha Franklin, Lou Rawls, Teddy Pendergrass, Linda Clifford, Tower Power, of course, Diana Ross, where I first heard her group's name mentioned. Well, okay, Diana called them the Jones Sisters,
right,
on that live record. But anyway, they came to my hometown of Philadelphia around 79, worked under the mighty Philadelphia International Records empire, releasing hit after iconic hit. From the Hove sample, You're Gonna Make Me Love Somebody Else, to like Dance Turn Romance, to my all-time favorite Nights Over Egypt, to Who Can I Run To, so many to name. Also, I'll say that our guest today enjoyed her first number one hit single, Do You Get Enough Love, 86, 2 years after she left for a solo career. And with 6 LPs under her belt with her family, 2 solo records, our guest is still holding the mantle and kind of the legacy of the Jones girls in her hands. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to Questlove Supreme, the one and only Shirley Jones. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Hey.
How are you?
I'm fine. I'm doing really good. Staying in the house, which is the safest place right now.
Exactly. That's, yes. That's all we're doing, staying in the house, you know. No, I thank you for doing this. I will say that after a lot of stalking on Instagram and social media, I was happy. I was fortunate enough to get your attention to come and join us on the show, because
I'm so happy because I mean, I'm a fan, so I'm fanning out right now.
Thank you. I
absolutely
that.
You and the Roots, and I mean, the Tonight Show, we used to just sit there and watch the nights. One day we're gonna be on the Tonight Show. This is back when Johnny Carson was,
yeah.
So I'm a huge fan.
Well, I mean, I'm a fan of yours as well, of course. Like, I've known, you know, as a Philadelphian, I've learned of your history after you came to Philadelphia to sign to the label. But I'm really curious about that, the first part of your career in Detroit, Michigan. What part of Detroit did you guys grow up in?
we grew up on the west side. You know, it's east side and west side. West side, we went to Central High School.
That's the nice part of Detroit, right?
Yeah. No, absolutely not.
No, okay. Well, see, I'm told by a lot of, I'm told by Detroit luminaries that if someone's from the east side, I should watch my wallet. But
right.
If someone's from the west side, then, you know, they might have finished high school.
Right. Okay. No, I mean, it's an okay. It's okay.
Okay.
All
right. So I always start with, what was your first musical memory?
My first musical memory was me and my mom singing, just the two of us. Once she found out that I could sing at like 6 years old, she was a very popular gospel singer back in the Detroit area, Mary Frazier Jones. Okay. In fact, she was the first Black gospel singer that RCA Records, they signed my mother to the gospel label the same day they signed Little Richard. So, yeah, and once she discovered that I could sing, I remember going around to these different churches singing just the two of us when it was just she and I.
Okay, when you say just the two of us, I'm instantly thinking like,
just
wait,
the two of
time
us. Yeah.
There's another just the two of us you're speaking
right. It's a gospel song, just the two of us.
Okay, I see. In the lineup of your sisters, where do you fall? Are you the
I'm the oldest.
Okay. You're the oldest sister.
Yes.
So was it just you three in the household, or did you have other siblings?
No, through my mother and father's union, it's just the three of us. But there are like five other kids by three other different women.
Okay.
That, you know, wives and you know,
your dad.
Not wives. Yeah. He was a minister too.
Like, that's all. Yo, you didn't even have to say that. I was going to say, hey, was your dad a preacher?
Yes, he was. Yes. My mother was the second wife, or second, maybe third.
Okay.
There were five. Yeah.
I feel you. So basically, what was your childhood like? Because I'm always curious as to how, especially when groups that I admire sort of unfold in the 70s, they all seem to have the same kind of narrative, which is that they start in gospel music. Mm-hmm. And I'm always curious to see how they are kind of able to unwrap themselves out of gospel. Like, some answers are like, you know, it was a controversial thing to start singing secular, and some, you know, they were embraced by their church and their family, and whatnot. But what was your relationship with music when you were growing up? Like, were you allowed to listen to both or just gospel in the house?
Oh, no, she allowed us to listen to both. It was very difficult after being with her, because we were traveling around Detroit. You know, Detroit's the music city, Motown, but as well as gospel. The Detroit's choirs were known all over the world. Aretha Franklin's father, his church. Mm-hmm. So we were traveling that circuit around Detroit, Chicago, and singing behind my mother. My mother was also the music director at Russell Street Baptist Church, so she knew voices.
Oh, wow.
And I credit our harmonies and our vocalizing to my mother. My mother rehearsed us, oh my goodness, from the time I was about 7 or 8, and Brenda and Valerie were stair steps. So mm-hmm. once she realized what she had, she rehearsed us at least maybe 4 or 5 times a week. Other kids be out there playing, and we'd be put out there trying to play. But my godmother, who lived across the street, was the piano player. Mm-hmm. We always had a piano in our home because we studied piano. We all play piano. And my mother was like, okay, you guys come in. We're going to rehearse. She practiced our voices. She taught us how to lay back. If the note is too overpowering, she taught us diction. So I credit everything to her from teaching us early on. And then being on the same circuit as like the Clark sisters, the Winans back then, man, when Holland Joshua Holland reached out and wanted us to start to try to come to their label to first to sing background. A music merchant too. Yeah. Right.
Oh, okay.
My mother was just so, it took a lot of persuading, but she finally let us do it.
I'm curious as to, Okay, as to the training, because the thing is that in listening to your records, I noticed that you guys spend an equal amount of time singing in unison.
Yes.
In addition to your harmonies. And I always wanted to know what was the, because that was an unusual trademark. And I guess as a non-singer, like I'm a producer who's a non-singer. So I would automatically think, well, coming out the gate, everyone sings in harmony. But you guys had a really unusual process where you all sing together. So it was always like one voice to me.
Exactly. And that when my mother was training us, that's what she was. She would always grill us and she'd be like, I want you, Shirley, to pull back, or Brenda, I need you to come up more. Even when we're doing unison, she would say, because the ultimate goal is for your harmonies and your unisons to sound like a lead. And she drilled that in us. And one of the best memories that I have with my sisters is when it was just the three of us, after we started doing background for different people, when it was just the three of us together, no boyfriends, no, you know, nobody, mm-hmm. girlfriends hanging around with us, we would practice that. Because my mother had drilled it in us, we would practice that, whether we were doing background for somebody or working on our own project, it had to be right. And then Valerie, the youngest sister, she was blessed with near perfect pitch. So of course, she would always be like, that doesn't sound right. You're too sharp, Shirley, get the, you know. So we had so much fun practicing because we always strove to be, for our sound to be perfect, whether we were singing unison, harmony, singing behind Aretha Franklin, or doing a Jones Girls project.
Well, I know that you were always in the gospel choir, but, you know, I know that you're in Detroit, which even after they long, you know, migrated to Los Angeles, I'm certain that, you know, still with Luminary still there, like Funkadelic and whatnot. Like, what was the social interaction with other notable members of the Detroit musical community for you? Like, who was there a group of people that you hung with or notable people that we would know?
Not really. Well, when we went to Music Merchant, to Holland Dozier Holland's label, mm-hmm. we were doing background for like Chairman of the Board, Frida Payne,
okay.
Honeycomb. And at that time, we were, I guess, maybe 13, 14. In fact, when I was watching Summer of Soul, it took me way back and I was like, oh my God, half of those people that were involved in that we either met, we either worked with, and I said, mm-hmm. wow, what a blessing, because at that time in 69, we were like 12, 13 years old, and we had just started doing background at that age for Holland Dozier Holland, because they saw us on a gospel TV show in Detroit. Mm-hmm. And that was when we begged my mother, oh, this is Holland Dozier Holland, Motown, please let us do background. It's just background, Ma, just background. No, you know, and it's not gospel background, but please, Ma, please. So she finally let us do it. But the stipulation was she had to be there. She was at every session from the time I was 13 and we started doing it until I was 18, grown.
I know that since, you know, Ray Charles introducing quote unquote secular non-gospel lyrics to gospel music, that's always been an issue with the church and whatnot. But obviously you're coming from a younger generation that isn't so married to what your parents and grandparents sort of subscribe to. So, you know, who was your North Star as far as like, who did you grow up idolizing? Like who's the voice that you long to be, sort of not in a non-gospel way? Like, who were you listening to on the radio?
On the radio, all of Motown, the Temptations, the Four Tops, but the group that we idolized and used to have my mom make outfits for, of course, was the Supremes. We absolutely idolized the Supremes. We wanted to be like the Supremes.
Really?
Diana Live Ross. The dream. Yes, we wanted to be like the Supremes.
Okay, so we've asked another person that's once worked with Diana Ross what that experience was like. The story was humorous. No, they're talking about Sheila E.'s rather tense time under a camp. What was it like? And of course, I'm skipping. I want to know about all your background stuff. But what was it like to finally land that job?
It was amazing. We were perfectly happy. We had just moved to Detroit, to L.A., with McKinley Jackson. He was managing us at the time. Okay. And we were perfectly happy doing background sessions because we were doing like 3 and 4 a day. It was either us or the Waters that people wanted to do their background back then. Oh, yeah. Well, okay. Those are my buddies. Yeah, it was either us or them. That's who we were, those premier groups for background singing back then. And McKinley said, well, you know, Diana's auditioning for some singers and she's been turning everybody down, and you know, and he said, you guys want to try? We like, Diana? Yeah, I mean, you know, we're from Detroit. Hey, let's give it a shot. And so we went up there actually thinking we were singing for Gil Askey, her music director, and her road manager, Don Peek, up Laurel Canyon somewhere. And we went up there and McKinley started playing. We had rehearsed Ain't No Mountain High Enough and Reach Out and Touch Somebody's Hand for our audition. And right in the middle of singing, who comes down the hall but Diana Ross? And yeah, and the only words out of her mouth was, you guys are terrific. Can you get passports? We're going to London. And we, of course, you know, we were like, yeah, we can go to London. But we had to work out some things on our contract because of our background singing, which she did allow. We traveled 7 months of the year with her. And then when she was on hiatus, she did allow us to keep our background singing career for other artists.
Okay. So she held you on retainer, but you were allowed to.
We were allowed to sing, right? But we were still getting, you know, we were getting half of our paycheck,
right,
when she wasn't working. But okay, she still allowed us to do our singing, our background singing. And over the years, I have defended and said so many people have said, "What was she like?" I hear, you know, she's this, she's that, and the other. I said, let me just tell you one thing: she was the hottest entertainer in the world back in the 70s. Absolutely nobody was bigger than Diana Ross, except maybe Frank Sinatra. And she was a perfectionist. She was a female, and she was demanding. She demanded that from her band to her singers to be as into the show and rehearse and be on top of your gig as she was. And because that was drilled in us, and that's what we did anyway, she was absolutely one of the best people to work for. And she was so concerned for us, because up until we went to London with her, the only places we had been was Detroit, surrounding areas, and then California. And she loved and respected our sound so much that after the European tour is when she came to us. She was getting ready to do her yearly, twice a year residency at Caesar's Palace. And she came to us and said, you know, you girls are too good to be singing background behind me or anybody else forever. So, you know, I change clothes at least 5 times in my show. I want you to get a song together, and I want you to sing it. I'm going to bring you out, the Jones Sisters, and I'm going to introduce you to the world. And that's actually, she did that. We chose If I Ever Lose This Heaven from Quincy Jones' album that was hot back then. And that's how we got with Gamble and Huff at the Schubert Theater. Yeah. The Schubert Theater. And she called us, and Cynthia Biggs and Dexter Wanzel, they were in the audience, and they said, all they could think about and look at during the whole show was us. They kept saying, you hear those girls, you hear her background singers, they're tearing it up. And Gamble and Huff came backstage and they said, you guys are terrific. Are you signed with anybody? And we're like, no. And we're like, oh my God, Gamble and Huff asking us if we're signed with anybody. And so we went back to LA, and within a month, we had our attorneys work. We worked out the deal, and within 2 months, we were flown to Philadelphia to work on that first Jones Girls album.
Wow.
Yes.
That's amazing. That's amazing. Wait a minute. I always wanted to know, was this the tour where she would it would start with the video thing with the guys carrying her over?
No, this was before then.
Okay, because I always wanted to know how she did that illusion.
No. And,
okay. I was a kid when I seen it, like a long time ago, but.
Yeah.
Wow.
Can you also talk about like just the gig with her and how it was different than other background gigs as far as like, she said she changed her clothes 5 times. Did you guys get to change your clothes? Did you have the same outfit you had to wear every night? Or what, because it was Diana Ross, y'all had like a nice rotation. And what did she require before every show as far as rehearsal and stuff like that? It's the comparison to everybody else you work for.
With her being a perfectionist, we rehearsed a lot before we would go out on tour with her. I mean, we rehearsed a lot. And yes, she did curse. She would come in there, and she never had to curse at us because we were going to be on top of our game. But she would curse them out. And I often tell people, I said, now, if she were a man, like Frank Sinatra coming out cursing because somebody wasn't doing their absolute best and she felt that they should be, he'd be applauded. He would be applauded and said, oh, he's just such a strong individual. He makes sure that, you know, but because she's a woman and she was that demanding at that time, you know, women weren't supposed to, you know, come. If you weren't doing your job, you were supposed to be demure and say, well, would you please, you know.
She opened that door.
She would come in there cursing like a sailor. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
For Beyonce, it makes me think of Beyonce and who Beyonce is allowed to be today.
Yeah, exactly. So I give her kudos because she was demanding. Yes, she was, but she was also she would also make sure that she was doing as far as rehearsing too. She was always immaculate, impeccable. Two people that I learned the most from as far as entertaining myself, I always say, is Diana Ross and Eddie LaVert from the OJs, because they are show people. Ooh. Absolutely show people.
I can't wait to hear what you learn from Eddie.
I want to know, for you, or is it a thing where the grass is greener on the other side? Do you prefer studio sessions, or do you prefer traveling? This I'm talking strictly in terms of your days as a background singer.
As a background singer, I prefer being in the studio. Yeah, I prefer being in the studio because I'm more of a, when we were traveling doing background for her, that was exciting because that was the first time we, you know, were traveling doing background and making money. Mm-hmm. But now, I mean, I prefer the doing studio work versus traveling, singing background for someone.
Isn't it a bigger pressure though in the studio? Because I'm almost certain that there's really not enough time for you to, you borderline have to catch it and perfect it in a short amount of time, I would assume, correct?
Yeah.
As far as nailing backgrounds.
Yeah. In real time. That's one of the reasons why, so many people wanted us to do background, because they knew that we were going to rehearse so much so that when we got in the studio, you know, time is money. We would knock that stuff out just like that. That's why sometimes we would have 2 and 3 sessions a day, because we were able to, we would rehearse and practice our parts for whoever, and to make sure that when we went in the studio, bam, 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 we could do it. And, you know, back in the day, you're talking about 8 tracks, and you're talking about not being able to sing one little part and then they fly it through the song. You had to sing that exact same way, 4 and 5, you know, 3, to double it. And I think that's one of the reasons why the artists today don't, as far as live performances, they cannot do it like us that were trained to have to sing a song all the way through 3 and 4 different times to stack that harmony and sound the exact same way each time.
Right. I see. I agree with you.
Curious, who were your peers, or I don't want to say competitors, but who were the peers who, if you can't get the Jones sisters, you know, we should call so-and-so?
The Waters.
The Waters.
That was it.
It was just y'all too.
And it was us in California for the longest. Yeah, that was it.
I'm sorry, man.
Yep.
Yeah. So what, I know you mentioned working under Holidays in Holland. When you came to Los Angeles, what year was that?
We went to Los Angeles in 1975. Mm-hmm. Yeah, about 75, 76. That's when Motown moved, and then, you know, they had given Holland Dozier Holland the Invictus and the Music Merchant labels.
Right.
And I think Motown moved, what, in 73, 74, and then those, like, McKinley and Holland Dozier Holland moved out, I think, 75.
So it was just basically everyone in Detroit was migrating to Los Angeles, and we might as well follow suit and follow them as well.
And follow them, exactly. Exactly.
I see. Could you tell me, like, what other notable acts were you singing background for that we might not be aware of?
Helen Reddy, Cher.
What songs?
Helen Reddy. Oh my God. Somebody just posted it the other day. I forgot that song that we did for her. We did the entire album because she just passed, I think, recently, and someone mm-hmm. posted it. Cher.
For Cher, like Half Read or Take Me Home or?
I forgot what song it, but the song that we did do for Cher, I don't think it made the album.
Okay.
But we did a session. We did a session because we did two songs with her and they never met. I don't think they made the album. Now somebody's going to probably prove me wrong and post it, you know.
Okay. I know that you've done background on some notable Philly International songs as well. So am I to assume that you're basically all the female voices that I hear on, like, You'll Never Find Another Love Like Mine and those songs as well, like with Lou Rawls? And
now we did do Lou Rawls' album. There was a group of girls in Philadelphia. I can't think of their names that were doing a lot of background singing for Gamble and them. Okay. Because once we became the Jones Girls, you know, we didn't do as much background singing for other people. Once we got with Gamble and Huff in 79, it just select people, you know, when we had the time, because, you know, with You're Gonna Make Me Love Somebody Else coming out the box being so big, Gamble immediately sent us to Ohio with Charlie Atkins, who put the OJs and Temptations with him. And we were rehearsing to go out on tour with the OJs, who took
Wow, you were trained under Charlie Atkins?
Oh, yes.
What was that like?
Oh, man.
Because I know he was a taskmaster. He was.
And I have two left feet, so he was always on me. He was constantly on me because I was the only one that couldn't dance. Brenda and Valerie could dance, you know. And me, I'd always try to, well, I'm singing lead anyway. Can I just stand on? No, you cannot. You're going to do those harmonies. Doing them too, girl. And so, oh, he was a test. And you just eat a banana. Eat a banana before you come in here to rehearsal for that potassium so you can move those feet. <You know? laughs> He was a drill master.
No, I heard he's every act that's ever worked with him.
Oh, my God.
Wait, what period were you guys with Aretha Franklin?
We did the Almighty Fire album with her.
Oh, God.
Yes.
76.
Yes.
Wait, only say this because the kind of household I grew up in, mm-hmm. I grew up with three binge shoppers when it came to records. So like every week, stacks and stacks and stacks of 45, stacks and stacks and stacks of 33s would come in the house. But the thing is that I would get the records that my parents didn't want. So, you know, as far as my Aretha collection, like there was a period like Almighty Fire, the U record, all the way up to La Diva, like basically the post Sparkle records that really weren't hitting the same.
Right.
I inherited. So I know all those like Sweet Passion, like all those Aretha records that weren't quite, you know, up there with the legacy albums. What was it like? Oh, God. And she was wearing that space suit, too.
Yep.
The green space. I remember that period. Well, what was it like, and how intimidating is it, you know, working with her? Or was she just, you know, another Detroit person that you could connect with?
Well, we had sang as children at her father's church with my mother one Sunday.
Okay.
When we were there, I believe it was one of her father's anniversary. And mm-hmm. we knew that she was going to be there at that time. She was a superstar. She had respect out, you know, she was mm-hmm. like, and they said she was going to be at the church. And after we performed, she came up to my mother and said, boy, those are some singing girls you got there. And then fast forward, like 15 years later, we were doing Almighty Fire. And what a lot of people don't know is that when that Sparkle movie was, you know, they were looking for the actor, the actors and actresses for that movie, Aretha Franklin and Kenny Gamble wanted us to play the sisters. Aretha pitched in for, she wanted us to do it because of our voices, and we had just sang on her album, right. And Kenny felt that would be a great, we were the, you know, the Jones girls. He felt that we were just coming out. That would great be perfect. Promo. They sent us to New York in a limo. And it was, I think they both were very, and I know we were disappointed, especially when, and you know, Aretha, she was an activist back then, especially when those girls, they, you know, was very light, bright girls mm-hmm. that got right. the part. Her thing was to them was, you know, this is ridiculous. Those girls can, you know, they're singers and they could be taught to be actresses too. Mm-hmm. And she was quite upset about that.
Yeah. So there was almost a chance that you could have
had
a chance to sparkle. Wow.
Yes.
At least sing the songs.
That is crazy.
You know? Yeah.
Yeah.
Was there ever a background gig that you had that was like a little too intimidating or that you know, was just all right to you?
No, we no matter who the artist was, and there were a lot of artists that, you know, hadn't even made it yet, but you know, if we liked the song and you know they were willing to pay the money, you know, we mm-hmm. were we would do it and we would give our best. And the thing that a lot of people don't know is that another reason why so many people liked us is because we created a lot of those backgrounds. They knew that if they gave us the song, we were going to create the background parts.
Oh,
and so I mean,
so you do the actual arrangement.
Mm-hmm, some for a lot. Okay. Now some did come with, you know, specific backgrounds, but our reputation became such that they'd be like, okay, well, hey, here's the song. What do you guys think?
Well,
you know,
and then drop a few, Shirley. Drop a few.
Norman Connors, mm-hmm. Lou Rawls. Mm-hmm. Who else that they let us do just, you know, control the background? God, it's so many people.
Not just songs, but you were just like artists that were like, it don't matter what song I'm doing, let the Jones girls come in here
and do our thing. Wow. Now, if Brenda was alive, because her memory is so much better than mine, she can remember every single everything. Artist we did background on and, and everything. But me, it gets a little fuzzy sometimes, right? Because when people post stuff now and I'll be like, oh yeah, I remember that we did do that song, you know? So,
with signing to Philly International, I'll say that probably in my opinion, because, you know, my dad purchased all the records and played it at the house all the time. I will say that you guys were probably given a more contemporary, up-to-date sound than a lot of the acts that were on Philly International back then. Like, it was almost a thing where, you know, you knew instantly within the first 2 seconds that you were listening to a Philly International song based on like the trademark of the strings and all the mixing of the record or whatever. But like, You're Gonna Make Me Love Somebody Else sounded nothing like what Philadelphia, especially what was happening in 1979, like if anything.
For Philly International.
Right. Yeah.
Right? Because it was like a woman telling you better get your shit together.
Right, exactly. Right.
Yeah, so what, I would assume that it's still the same group of people. Like it's still Dexter Wanzel and Gamble and Huff and all those other, well, I know McKinley Jackson also worked on the record as well, but
right.
Like, what was the discussion basically on how to present you guys and your sound?
That's one of the things that I think Gamble and Huff, they were purposely trying to take us away just a little bit from the strings and horns of like, say, like of what they did with 3 Degrees.
3 Degrees, right. Uh-huh. Okay.
And they wanted us to be more funky, more soulful, more R&B. And if you notice the very first Jones Girls album, that's exactly, I mean, I'm At Your Mercy's on there, which is a, you know, heart-wrenching ballad. Then, of course, there's You're Gonna Make Me Love Somebody Else.
Also like Show Love Today.
There's, yeah, exactly. So
and
it
Who
was,
Can I Run To?
Yeah, Who Can I Run To? That yes. Part. Yep.
What were your feelings on, of course, not what your feelings on, were you, how did it feel for Escape to sort of reintroduce that song to a whole new generation?
Yeah, when I first heard it, it was, 1995. So if by that time it was 16 years future from when we did
right.
it. And so many, I remember so many of the producers that when Gamble, back in the day, you know, you had an A side and a B side on records.
Mm-hmm.
And Who Can I Run To was on the B side,
right.
And so many people did not want Gamble to put that. They said, put Show Love Today, put anything on that, on the B side of You're Gonna Make Me Love Somebody Else besides Who Can I Run To, because that is a single of its own. But of course, that didn't happen. So... we were working and the girls and I had broken up by then. And when we heard, Who Can I Run To, I was happy actually, because back then when their record came out, there were so many DJs that were, you know, knew that we had done it first, because people used to flip it on the radio sometimes and play Who Can I Run To.
Right.
So what they would do is like, I know you guys love this one by Escape, but guess what? Escape didn't do it first. Then they would play our version too and have people call in which version they like the best and all of that. And I happened to, the girls were on a radio show some years back, and they said, we hope we did a good job. But we just love you guys and love you all sound. And I told them, I said, you all did a great job, because what you did was you brought back a lot of attention to the Jones Girls. So
absolutely.
I told them, I said, so, hey, thank you all, because it brought back some attention, because I mean, up until, you know, from 16 years later, you know, we had kind of died out. Like we weren't together anymore. We had, we would do some things occasionally over in Europe, but it brought back a lot of attention and put that Jones Girls name back out there.
I'm wondering how Dexter and Gamble and Huff worked in a writing sense, in the sense of they writing all these kind of like female run, these songs for women. Do you ever get to say anything about a lyric? Did you ever get to say, well, I don't know if she would say it like this, but she might say it like that? Or was it always just their words, sing it and let's go?
Oh no, they allowed us to put in it, you know, just like, I Just Love the Man. When we were in the studio doing I Just Love the Man, there was no talking up front at all. And Gamble kept saying...
Oh, you add that.
Yeah, oh yeah. Gamble kept saying...
That's a little trademark. You put that on Get Enough Love as well.
Right.
Exactly.
Yeah, Gamble said, the song is great. I love it, but something is missing. Now, little did we know, he was in the control booth, and I was going through some things in my relationship with McKinley at the time, and my sisters were, and we didn't know our mics were open, and they were like, girl, we're so sick of you and McKinley and all this drama, you know, you just need to leave him. And, you know, Mama said it, and then Kenny said, that's what we need. We need that right there.
That's wild.
That's what we need.
Serious?
I'm serious.
Mike in the studio. And he told,
we didn't know he was listening to us. And he said, that's what we need. Take a break. So we went in and wrote out what we were saying. And that's how those talking parts got in there.
Always be recording.
That's the first time that you did your infamous Shirley Jones
rap. Right.
That was an error, man. People don't shit talk into me in the beginning no more.
Right.
Especially with women.
Yeah.
Like, not since the days of Barbara Mason and
Right, do it,
do all of them. The other woman, or Dorothy Moore, or you right. know.
Amir, aren't you bringing back interlude culture? Right on Breakfast.
Yes, I'm bringing it back.
Bring it back.
Good.
Exactly.
So that's an aspect I will bring of here. You gotta bring.
At at the time when you're recording these records, I know that. Well, you mentioned earlier that your album is more funk-based instead of disco-based. Was it also intentional to, even though 79 was still, you know, kind of a heavy disco tornado still happening, was it sort of pre-planned for you guys to not lean so heavy into disco, more into what I call boogie? Or funk?
Oh, funk, yes, yeah. It was. Because we kept, I mean, disco kind of like exploded right there with You're Gonna Make Me Love Somebody Else. And we would, they would want us to perform in clubs like Studio 54 and all those places. And we didn't really want to perform You're Gonna Make Me Love Somebody Else because it didn't have that disco tempo to us, we thought. But mm-hmm. but it became a big disco record. And
right.
so those different studios in New York and different places would have us come in. But we would always tell Gamble we thought it was a little slow for disco, but hey, they did a remix that was like 12 minutes long or something, and that was the disco version. So that's how it became popular.
Wait, can I ask one more thing? So when you guys are touring, I always wanted to know this because you guys would also, or at least to me, you know, you would stack your background parts on your records and also have counterparts. Yes. Singing with you, and I always wanted to know how you guys pulled that off live when it was just three of you. But then I thought, well, if it's just the three of you, then obviously you would also have to have background singers for you guys as well. And was that how you handled it? But
no, we did.
Really?
When we would conduce it down for stage, we would take the heavy parts that we know people wanted to hear.
Right.
And it was the hardest thing for me because I'm the top note
and I
was singing lead and then having to jump back. That's why now when I travel, I have three background singers that I have trained that have been with me for 10 years. And they know all the I call them my little Jones girls because they know all our parts and everything, which frees me up to be able to do my thing vocally. But it was so hard. But because we always insisted on doing our own backgrounds. We didn't want to have anybody else on the side doing our, and the only time we kind of got away from it, we had a female MD, Myra, that played keyboards, and she would sing my top note. She was with us for maybe almost a year, and that I was able to really get into my leads and stuff then when she was our MD, but that was only for about a year.
Wow. Okay. I always wanted to know that because like, again, you guys are so intricate with the Jones Girl sound of stacking.
Right.
That I was like, well, if it's three of them, you know, on stage, then I know there has to be an additional three voices to help all those counterparts that are swimming around in the song as well.
No, but we because of the insistence of us never wanting anybody to do our backgrounds, and Charlie Atkins, he was like, no, because
and you have know, you they, dancing too,
yeah, and have us dancing, and you know, and then they back in the day, we just didn't want it. We didn't want any background singers. We wanted people to hear us, and we practiced, I mean, 24/7, and especially when we were on the road, we'd be in there practicing right before hitting the stage just to make sure that mm-hmm. everybody's voices were on, you know, on top of what's because of what we were getting ready to do.
So another question I have is because there's so many writing teams at Gamble and Huff,
mm-hmm.
how are the decisions made on who you're going to work with? Like, do you guys say, hey, we like what Cynthia has for us, so let's work with Cynthia Dexter, or is like McFadden Whitehead, like there's so many teams there, How do you?
We had a, and in fact, it was so impressive when our first day, we took that elevator up on that little creaky elevator up on 309, and they gave
309 Broad Street.
Broad Street. They.
I went to elementary school right next door at Performing Arts. At 313 Broad Street.
Right. So. Okay. Right up the street. Yes.
Yeah.
And they gave us a schedule. Everybody had little offices with a keyboard and a recorder. They gave us a schedule, like from 10 to 12, we were going to be with Dexter and Cynthia. Then take lunch. And then from 2 to 4, we'd be with McFadden and Whitehead. And then from 6 to 8, we would be with Joe Jefferson, Charlie Boy Simmons, the guys that did Who Can I Run To. Then every writer and producer got a chance to submit their songs within those 2 hours. Then the next day, the schedule would start all over again because it was so many of them. And then, of course, also during that time, we would Jet Gamble and Huff had written their songs, and we would get with everybody, and we would do little demos of the ones that we liked, wanted to do. And then that's how we would choose which ones were going to be recorded. We'd sit down with Gamble and Huff at the end of the week, and they say, well, we think you all should do this one, this one, this one.
Can you tell us what was I really don't know. Like, I always seen Cynthia Biggs's names on every credit forever, but she's probably the only Philly luminary that I've yet to meet or knew about.
Yes, and I tell her all the time, she to me is the most underrated writer.
Yes.
Because she's like a Carole King to me, that girl. Because, yes. Oh my God, yes.
Yes.
I mean, Love TKO, If Only You Knew, yeah. Living All Alone. Yes. I mean, all of her songs are such classics. And, you know, a lot of people don't realize that, you know, because of course she was writing partner with Dexter Wanzel, and everybody know Dexter.
He took all the right. He took all, right,
exactly.
Right, the sign, right.
But when she was telling us how she went to the library to study the Egypt during the time of writing, Nights Over Egypt, because she wanted to make sure that she was lyrically writing to that time period. I knew then, I'm like, this girl, you know, and I've gone on to do demos for her on so many beautiful, absolutely beautiful songs that didn't come out, but I mean, she's incredible, an absolutely incredible writer.
And y'all still speak, Shirley? So you know where is she?
Oh, she's in Philadelphia. Yeah, she. Yeah,
we gotta find her.
Yeah,
man.
We'll find.
Yes.
Her.
I can get you in touch with her. Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, because she's written way too many hits. There's one song.
Yeah.
There's one song I've always been curious about. On your second record, on a Piece of a Woman, there's a song called "Let's Celebrate."
Mm-hmm. Sitting on now, top of the world. Yeah.
Right. So the thing is that I know, on the writer's credit, that I saw both Lou Rawls and Teddy Pendergrass's name in the writer's credit.
Yeah, they put, I think
how
they
does,
put.
How, what was that writing session like? Like, was that real or was that a typo or?
I think, because Cynthia.
Cause Cynthia Dex, Biggs, Dexter,
right,
Wanzel,
Dexter Wanzel.
Lou I Rawls think, and Teddy Pendergrass.
I think that was, to be honest with you. In fact, I'm almost sure they put like a lyric or two in there, and one, you know, and because of their name at the time.
Oh, okay.
They put, you know, a few of the lyrics in there.
Oh, i.e. Dinah Ross,
right.
Jackson 5.
Right. Yeah. Exactly.
Writer's room bureaucracy. You know how it goes.
But exactly. It's just so unusual to see. It's so random. Like, wait, I can't imagine Lou Rawls, Teddy Pendergrass,
right,
a legal pad at a piano.
Right.
Yeah.
No, that's just like Cynthia wrote Love TKO, but Teddy, I think Teddy's name got on there too.
God,
or no, Gamble's name. Gamble's name.
And Womack.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh no. We
got to
find Cynthia. This ain't.
Yeah, we got to find Cynthia.
Big. Yeah. I definitely Layla, I'll send you her number. I'm going to get in contact with her first because we haven't spoken for a while, but I will. Yeah, and get you her number and her information. She would love to do it. Yes.
We would love that. Okay, yeah, I was going to say, you know, probably when the smoke clears, I would say that the average Jones Girl fan will always put Nights Over Egypt as their almost their top song.
Yes.
Which was so unusual at the time.
Yes.
So, like,
it's amazing.
What's the genesis of the song and how did it wind up in your hands?
Well, it wound up in our hands. Dexter and Cynthia presented it to us. And we actually ended up recording it thanks to my baby sister, Valerie, because Brenda and I did not want to do the song. We thought it was too jazzy. And coming behind, I just love the man and you're going to make me love somebody else. We thought it was too jazzy. So we sat down and it was like Brenda, Valerie, myself, Dexter, and Cynthia. And we said, because the music is just it's so different. And Dexter said, yes, it is. And so then Valerie said, so it's beautiful. She said, so what we should do is do a different type of singing on it. And we're like, what, Valerie? And so after talking, she said, why not have no lead singer? But you know how you mom always said, let the unisons and harmonies be a lead. And then with me and Brenda and I said, oh, and then Dexter and Cynthia said, hey, that's interesting. Let's try that. We went in the studio 2 takes after rehearsing. Brenda and Valerie and I got together and we decided where we were going to do the unison, where we were going to do the harmonies. 2 takes it took us. And it was done. I knew then that was a special song because a lot of the other songs, like You Gonna Make Me Love Somebody Else and Who Can I Run To? It took more takes than 2 to get it right to the point of where everybody felt comfortable that this was a hit. But it was just 2 takes with Nights Over Egypt.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It's amazing too, because it was actually the 3rd single. Valerie's also the one that said that should be the 1st single. But during that time, Gamble and Huff always had to have the 1st single on the Jones Girls, and it had just become. But Valerie, she was so upset. Nights Over Egypt should be the 1st single off of that Get As Much Love As You Can album. And it actually came off as a 3rd single. And that's only because Quiet Storm just forgot about Finally Found That Man of Mine and Get As Much Love As You Can singles. And everybody across the country just started playing Nights Over Egypt.
Did you say Quiet Storm?
Too. Yeah. Quiet Storm Radio.
Was there ever a debate about that intro? Like was there ever a debate like, this is way too long, we need to come in soon? From the moment you heard the intro, you were like, all right, I know you thought it was crazy when you first heard it, but when y'all all came together for the song.
No, we were grooving off of it. But the breakdown, you know, when I do it on stage, the first time I tried to
I was about to say, that must be a nightmare for your band.
Oh my God.
If they're not familiar.
Oh, and they
got to get it right.
They have to get it right. And then when I cut it down to, you know, to take out the instrumental part, oh my God, they would all like, can't take the instrumental. This gives us,
that prepares
I've let keyboard players go auditioning for me because they couldn't get it. They could not get it right. It has to be right. They would do everything. and Dexter would laugh. I said, Dexter, when keyboard players audition, if they don't get it, they're out of there. I can't.
Don't try to remix it. Don't try to make
right.
Boy. Yeah. Wow. That turnaround, I can hear your bands right now sweating, looping that intro over and over and over again. Yeah. I do not want to be the MD for that particular show.
Right.
In 83, you guys made a curious move. Okay, for starters, can you explain, because you're probably the first Philly international artist that we've had pre-81 on the show. Can you explain to me how the after effect of Teddy Pendergrass's car accident affected the entire label? Because I can only assume that there was a slow implosion of Philly International after 82, because most acts will, half the acts will leave the label a year later.
Right.
Of course, you know, the signature Gamble and Huff sound, even though Patti LaBelle sort of kept the lights on, if you will.
Right.
Pretty much, you know, every act was going elsewhere, you know, to figure the 80s out. So did his accident actually have an effect on the entire label, as far as it being a label, being operational, as far as in the eyes of, well, I know that Clive Davis wasn't running Philly International at the end of its run. He signed the label to Columbia in 73, but yeah, what was the general atmosphere of the label in late 82 post-accident?
That accident was, that was, it affected the label, because, I mean, Teddy was the hot guy, you know, he was the main success at that point. And I mean, right, we were doing okay. The OJs, I think they were getting ready to leave if they hadn't already left. And
right,
I think Billy Paul had left or was in the process of leaving.
Right.
And things were just changing. I mean, disco by this time was just taken over everything. And Gamble and Huff were still writing basic R&B, you know, the, mm-hmm, that sound. So it affected it to the point where I think that was when Philly International really started going down. And mm-hmm, we, of course, we weren't sure if Kenny was going to re-sign us. And we were having a lot of internal, by this time, we were having a lot of internal problems. Group, my sisters and I.
Just as sisters?
Yes, as sisters. And
that's one question I didn't ask. How do you guys navigate as a group, as business partners, but also, you know, as, I mean, your sisters at the, you know, at the end of the day. So it's almost like you don't have an option to not to go to bed angry about something, or.
Yeah, we didn't for a long time. Everything was fine. But then after the second album, it became, you know, more and more pronounced, certain mm-hmm, certain things that we were dealing with internally, and we decided and a lot of it was over who was gonna be lead singer.
I was gonna say, how hard was it for you?
Yeah,
because I know the whole thing, like, let's all be unison, but at the end of the day, it's like, yeah, someone at the label has to be like, look, y'all, we're gonna have to focus on somebody here. So who is it?
Well, see, what happened was, when we went into Gamble and Huff, my sisters were so used to all of us sharing lead and everything, but Gamble and Huff had to sit Brenda down in particular, because there had always been this thing that she felt she should be the lead singer. But
right,
after the first album and the success of that first album, Kenny had to tell Brenda that, he said, now every group has a signature voice now, and we feel that the most commercial signature voice for the Jones Girls is Shirley. So yes, we're gonna, you know, to have you do some songs, but the bulk of the songs we want Shirley to do. And that was always an issue between Brenda and I. Mm-hmm. And that was the main cause of us breaking up for the final time. Yes.
Mm-hmm. On the third album, not the third album, the fourth album, On Target, I know that you guys went to RCA. What caused the split from Philly International in 83?
We weren't sure that he was going to sign us, and Brenda became friends with Robert Wright, who's now deceased, and Fonzie Thornton. Robert was
the great
over,
Fonzie Thornton.
Yes, yeah. My Fonzie. Yeah. And he, Robert Wright and Fonzie got together, and Robert was the head of RCA at that point. Mm-hmm. And he and Brenda had become friends. And I think he had kind of told her, you know, that she, it would be more equal leads.
Distribution.
Yeah. Right. So we got over there, and the same situation happened. Once they would hear my voice on the songs that Fonzie and Robert wrote, they wanted mm-hmm. me, and that set up a issue between Brenda and Robert and me. And then, you know,
right.
And that's why it was just that one album. But the interesting thing is that we had an album in the can at Philly International that Kenny Burke had done called Keep It Coming.
The Keep It Coming album, yeah.
Yeah, and he okay. Gamble released that, and that album, he released that like 3 months after RCA, I think, and
right.
That album did better than the On Target album.
Right.
So, and then from there, that's when the group broke up totally, you know, and then Gamble called me to come back to do my solo project.
Yeah, I know that oftentimes, and you know, it's always like the similar to the Supreme situation, where it's like sometimes the best singer or the best singer or the best voice or the strongest voice, whatever, doesn't mean the most commercial voice. And a lot of times people don't, you know, I think people understand in hindsight.
Yes. Like,
and years after the fact.
After the fact. And I would tell Brenda all the time, Brenda has that really mid-tones mm-hmm. in her voice, but she could also sing very high, but her voice is so full. And I used to tell her, you have a beautiful voice. You could just, you know, do the songs that they put, like I Close My Eyes on one of the albums she's doing, mm-hmm. and on that Keep It Coming album. You can hear the tones in her voice that were just rich. And that's why I couldn't understand why she just always, it was such a battle too. Even when for Unsung, when Kenny and I were talking about when he was getting ready to do his Unsung part, he said, you know, I never thought Brenda liked me when after I sat down and told you all that it was your voice.
Oh, you think?
he said, I don't think she ever really liked me. I said, well, Kenny, I don't think she liked me either. And I was her sister, but because
right.
That was a hard conversation that he did, but he had to have it.
So yeah. I'm curious too, though, because you guys have been singing since you guys were little. You've been in with your mom. Was there ever any conversations to help prevent these kind of moments? Like, listen, girls, they're going to try to break you up, or listen, girls, somebody may sing.
She did. My mom did. And we were the best of friends. We never fought, because she always said, don't fight. I mean, you know, verbally we would go at each other, but we would never physically, because, you know, we weren't raised in that kind of environment. But both of my sisters, which runs in our family, both had serious alcohol problems.
Okay.
That developed with Valerie. It started, you know, with the ending part with Diana Ross. And we found out about that a little later. But then with both of them, once we, really after that, once that first Jones Girls record, it just became more and more prevalent. And that, and then the jealousy issues as far as leading is what broke the group up, and is what killed both of my sisters, alcohol.
Wow.
Well, Brenda was struck by 3 cars, but it was because, As far as I know, all I know is that the police officers that had seen told me that day, earlier in the day,
right.
They had seen her walking down the street crying in Dover, Delaware, and they took her back to her hotel and told her, because they said she let them in and everything, and they told her, please, you know, stay in your room, contact your daughter, but don't go back out. And I told them, God, I wish they had my number or something at that time, because she was not going to stay in that room, right. You know. So that's what happened there in 2017 with her. Valerie, in 2001, she had just said that she was not going to, she wanted my mom to check her in because she was tired, and she really wanted, she knew that Brenda and I were talking about maybe doing something together with her again in 2001. Mm-hmm. And she had just said, well, Monday, I want you to take me. And she died from, you know, from her liver.
Yeah.
Wow. So that conversation we had about the Olympics and people taking mental breaks.
Oh, yeah.
Totally different to you.
Oh, mental health. And then, and that's why I told the people from Unsung, you know, they did a great job of telling the story, because both of my sisters, the drinking and then the Brenda's, in Brenda's case, taking those opioids because to just kill the pain. She was constantly in pain, she said, and instead of getting the help that she needed, with her, I was constantly telling her, Brenda, you're in pain because you really don't need more alcohol or another pill. You need to go talk to somebody. And I said, come talk to me. Come, you know, we could talk. But she wasn't ready. She wasn't ready to admit what was happening, and you know, she's no longer here because of it. And then both of her daughters were in denial too, and I told them, I said, you guys are the only ones that could physically take her somewhere to get help, and they refused to do it.
Wow.
Yeah,
man, that's important. Like,
oh, you have to. And it's because mentally, like, you know, this pandemic, this year and a half of just being in the house has almost driven me crazy. But I have a firm foundation. You know, I got three grandbabies, little ones, a 7-month-old and 2 3-year-olds that, you know, they give me all the life that you to want to keep living, to
depend on you,
stay out there. Exactly.
Yeah, that's important. Were you able at all to just have sort of a moment of reconciliation with them after the group imploded?
Even I want to say before Valerie passed, she and I were on good terms because of the boys. We both have sons that are both in the music business, and they got an EPK out now doing 6 of our songs, hip hop style, Cameron, right. And Cameron and PJ. And then with Brenda, thank God, she and I had not spoken about 3 or 4 years. And right 2016, we started speaking again and talking. And 2017, the year that she passed, it was April 3rd of 2017. She was coming. I was doing Essence. Mary J. Blige had gotten me on the Essence Music Festival. Oh, and wow. I had just told her, Diana was there the night before. And she said, Shirley, why don't we go? I'll meet you there and we'll go backstage and say hi to Diana. Wow. And I said, okay. I said, and don't be surprised if I bring you up on stage to perform with me the next night. I said, so are you ready? She says, yeah, I'm ready. She says, so I'm gonna meet you there. I said, I knew she was still having issues, but I felt that if I could get her there, that would help, you know, encourage her, especially to see the love that people have for the group.
Right.
That night before she passed, we had just talked, and I said, okay, now I'm getting ready to get your plane ticket so you could fly. Cause I thought she was in New York, but she was in Dover, Delaware with her daughter. And she says, all right, well, I said, so I'm gonna call you tomorrow and give you the plane information. And then 11 o'clock that morning is when I got the phone call that she had been hit by 3 cars. So, you know, I feel them every time I'm on stage, every time I'm in the studio, and I be laughing sometimes because I hear Valerie drilling me, talking about, Shirley, that note is a little sharp. You need to come down, or Brenda cracking some kind of joke. So that's one of the reasons. My therapy is continuing the legacy and singing and performing for the audiences.
Keeping the spirit alive. Yes. Absolutely. Can I ask what did it feel like when you struck out on your own and finally got your number one song?
Oh man.
With Do You Get Enough Love?
Yeah, I was you're talking about excited because we had never had a number one. We had had like a number three and number five, you know, mm-hmm. but we had never had a number one. And when they called me and told me that it had went to number one, I was like, oh my God, you don't, you can't. And I was in Chicago on my way up to do an interview for Jet magazine.
Right.
And once we got up there is when they, Kenny called to say, you got the number one record, girl. And I'm like, what? And, you know, and we, I think, cause I think us and Sweet Love had been battling going up, and then it stayed there for a couple of weeks. And I was happy, so happy about that. Now the first performance was scary because I call myself, I went back to Charlie Atkins and he said, well, let's just take it completely.
Just you alone.
you don't have to dance now, baby. But I decided to have two guys and a girl so that to take away from the Jones girls as background singers.
Right.
And he put a terrific show together. And the first night, I was so scared. It was in D.C. at Constitution Hall. I was with Maze. And yeah, and
that's a hard
I was
one in D.C.
And it was, you know, I was like, I don't know how people are going to accept, you know, the two guys and a girl and me, especially when I'm doing most of the songs. I mean, I had to do Jones Girl stuff because Do You Get Enough Love was the only thing I had had. And right. When I did it, at getting ready to leave my hotel room, they brought up like two dozen yellow roses from Diana Ross. And she said, get it. Go get them, girl. Number one. It made me feel so good just to go out there and perform. And I did. I did good. I mean, I toured with them for 7 months. So that Maze tour. Yeah, I did good.
I guess in closing, I'll ask, like, what do you want, or is there sort of like a bucket list achievement that you've yet to do that you would like to do, or what is it in the legacy of the Jones Girls do you want the world to know?
I want the world to know that the Jones Girls recognize and realize that we were blessed with three absolutely beautiful voices that blended so well together. Mm-hmm. And we knew that. And we also worked and practiced and practiced and practiced for that sound. And the reason why we practiced for that sound was to bring people the most beautiful harmonic music that at the end of the day, at the end of the show, at the end of the record, they would say, wow, they would feel uplifted, they would feel enlightened, and they would just feel joy and would just smile. Because that was the goal for me and my sisters. And my goal now, no matter what I do, I just want, when I'm performing, all I want to do at the end of the day is for people to smile and say, hey, man, we had a great time with that Jones Girls experience. So that's it.
Well, that's beautiful.
I had a great time with this.
You're not going to miss it.
Thank you.
We thank you. Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you.
We thank you for your music and your talent and, you know, and your sisters as well and your family.
Yeah.
Upholding the sound of Philadelphia, my hometown, representing Detroit.
Yes, that Philly sound, man. One of my fans said, Motown music had my mind. Philadelphia music has my soul and my spirit. Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah,
there's so the mic true. Drop for you right there. Well, on behalf of Shirley Jones, this is Questlove. And on behalf of Sugar Steve and Unpaid Bill, Fontigolo and Laia, we thank you for another great episode of Questlove Supreme. We will see you guys on the next go-around.
Thank you all. Bye-bye.
Yo, what's up? This is Fonte. Make sure you keep up with us on Instagram at QLS and let us know what you think and who should be next to sit down with us. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast. All right? Peace.
Questlove Supreme is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.